This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the September 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Soft Death by Rudy Rucker. "I'm sorry, Mr. Lekesh," said the doctor, nervously tapping on his desk screen. "There's no doubt about it. The tests are all positive." "But surely," began Lekesh. His voice came out as a papery whisper. He cleared his throat and tried again. "I mean, can't you put a new liver in me? I can afford the organ and I can afford the surgery. My God, man, don't just sit there and tell me you're sorry. What am I paying you for?" At the mention of money, Lekesh's voice regained its usual commanding tone. The doctor looked uncomfortable. "I am sorry, Mr. Lekesh. The cancer has metastasized. Tumor cells are established in every part of your body." He fingered some T's and green lines formed on his screen. "Step around the desk, Mr. Lekesh, and look at this." It was the graph of an upsloping curve with dates along the horizontal axis and percentages along the vertical axis. The graph was captioned, "Projected Mortality of Douglas Lekesh." "These are my odds of dying by a given date?" barked Lekesh. What a fool this doctor was to let a computer do all his thinking. "You've got this all projected like some damned commodities option?" "Most patients find it reassuring to know the whole truth," said the doctor. "Today is March 30th. You see how the curve rises? We have a 50% chance of your death before May 1st, a 90% chance before July 1st, and virtual certainty by late September. You can trust these figures, Mr. Lekesh. The Bertroy Medical Association have the best computers in New York." "Turn it off," cried Lekesh, smacking the screen so hard that its pixels quivered. "I came here to see a doctor. If I wanted to look at computer projections, I could have stayed in my office down on the street." The doctor sighed and turned off his terminal. "Your experience denial, Mr. Lekesh. The fact is that you're going to die. Make the most of the time you have. If you want a non-computerized projection, I'll give you one." The doctor stared briefly at the cityscape outside his window. "Don't expect much more than 3 weeks before your final collapse." Lekesh found his way out of the Bertroy building and into the morning roar of Madison Avenue. It was 10:30. He had business meetings, but what difference would more millions make now? At least he should call Abby. She'd be waiting to hear. But once he told Abby, she'd only get right to work planning her own future. If he, Doug Lekesh, was the one doing the dying, why should he do anything for anyone anymore? Abby could wait. Business could stop. Right now, he wanted a drink. The weather was raw and blustery, with a little snow in the air. The sky was 50 different shades of gray. One of the new robot taxis slowed invitingly as Lekesh approached the curb. He owned stock in the company, but today, of all days, he didn't feel like talking to a robot. He waved the cab off and kept walking. His club was only 4 blocks off. There was a bar at the next corner, apparently non-automated. Lekesh hadn't entered a public drinking place for years, but a certain gust of cold wind urged him in. He ordered a beer and a shot of scotch. The bartender looked sympathetic. Lekesh had a sudden flash that someone with cancer came in here every day. There were lots of doctors in the Bertroy building. There were lots of people with cancer. There were lots of people who handled stress with alcohol. "I'm ready for spring," observed the bartender when Lekesh ordered his second round. He was a broad-faced Korean with a New Jersey accent. "I got a garden up on the roof, and I'm dying to put the seedlings in." "What do you grow?" asked Lekesh, thinking of his father. Papa had put a garden in the back of their little tract home every summer. "This is living, Dougie," Papa would say, picking a tomato and biting into it. "This is what it's all about." "Lettuce," said the flat-faced Korean. "Bok choy, potatoes. I love new potatoes, the way they come up in a big clump of nuggets." Lekish thought about nuggets. Tumor cells in every part of his body. He sucked down his scotch and asked for another. "The main thing is fertilizer," said the bartender, placidly pouring out a shot. "Plants need dead stuff, and often stuff all crumbly and black. It's the cycle of nature, death into life." "I'll be dead in a month," said Lekish. The words jumped out. "I just saw my doctor. I have cancer all over my body." The Korean stopped moving and looked into Lekish's eyes, just looked for a long few seconds, watching him like a TV. "You scared?" "I'm not religious," said Lekish. "I don't think there's anything after death. 3 more weeks and it's all over. I might as well never have lived." "You got a wife?" "Ah, she won't miss me. She'll talk about missing me. She likes to put on a show, but she won't really miss me. She'll take my money and find someone else, the little tramp." Speaking so unkindly about Abby gave Lekish a perverse and bitter satisfaction. The Korean kept watching him in that blank, judicious way. "You have a lot of money?" he asked finally. "Yes, I do," said Lekish, regaining his composure. "Not that it's any of your business. What's your name, anyway? I'll buy you a drink. Take it all out of this and keep the change." He threw a $200 bill on the bar. "My name's Young. I'm not supposed to drink on duty, but..." The Korean glanced impassively around the bar. There were a couple of old long hairs having coffee in the booths, but that was it. "Yeah, I'll take a Heineken." "That's a boy, Young. Get me one, too. Nothing but the best for Douglas Lekish. I'm full of nuggets. You can call me Doug. I was thinking before you must get a lot of death cases in this bar, being so close to the Bertroy building. It's all doctors in there, you know." "Oh, yeah," said Young, opening the 2 bottles of Heineken. He poured his into a coffee mug. "Bertroy Medical Associates. They have a teraflop diagnostic computer in the basement there. It does a trillion calculations a second, fast as a human brain. My sister helps program it. She's a smart girl, my sister Lo." He sipped at his mug and watched Lekish some more. "So you're going to die and you think that's it, huh, Mr. Lekish?" "Religion's wrong, Young, isn't it?" Lekish was feeling his drinks. "When I was your age, I didn't think so. Hell, I even used to paint pictures. But down on the street, nothing counts but numbers. I've got a seat on the exchange, you know that? So don't try and tell me about religion." Young looked up and down the bar and leaned close. "Religion's one thing, Mr. Lekish, but immortality's something else. Lowe says immortality's no big problem anymore." He drew a business card out of his pocket and handed it to Lekish. "This is modern. This is digital. Whenever you're ready for immortality, my sister Lowe's got it." Lekish pocketed the card without looking at it. All of a sudden, the beers and the 3 scotches were hitting him hard. The dull throb of his sick liver was filigreed with accents of acute pain. He was stupid to be drinking this early in the day, drinking and slobbering out his soul to a Korean bartender. Where was his self-control? Stiff-legged, he stalked into the men's room and made himself throw up. Better. He washed his face, first with hot and then with cold. He gargled and drank water from the tap. 3 weeks, the doctor had said. 3 weeks. Lekish left the bar and went home to Abby. Abby Lekish was a dark-haired woman with full cheeks and beautiful teeth. When they'd met 15 years ago, Lekish had been 50 and Abby 30. He'd still dreamed of being a painter even then, and he'd liked the bohemian crowd that Abby traveled in. But now, Lekish hated Abby's friends with an aging man's impotent jealousy. To his displeasure, Abby greeted the news of his impending death with what he took for enthusiasm. She believed in spirits and mediums, and She was confident that Lekesh would be able to contact her from beyond the grave. "Don't be downcast, Doug. You'll only be moving to a higher plane of existence. You'll still be here with me as a dear, familiar spirit." "Talk about a fate worse than death," snapped Lekesh. "I don't want to float around watching you spend my money on your boyfriends." For years now, he'd suspected her of being unfaithful to him. "I'll wear full mourning for 6 months," prattled Abby, ignoring his accusations. "I'll go out and buy some black dresses today, and we must have Irwin Garden over for tea. He's simply the most brilliant new medium in America. You should get to know his vibrations so he can contact you on the other side." Lekesh didn't dignify this with an answer. Abby went out in search of mourning clothes and Mr. Garden, while the robo-mat made Lekesh a veal cutlet for lunch. The meal cleared his head entirely, and he drew out the business card that the Korean bartender, Young, had given him. "Soft Death Incorporated. Scientific soul preservation and transmission. Strictest confidentiality. Call for an estimate today. Low Park. B, 1001 Birchroy Building. 840-0190. Lekesh studied the card for a while and made his decision. He'd be damned if he was going to let one of Abby's phony mediums get away with pretending to talk to his spirit. If there was anything to this scientific soul preservation, he'd be able to steal a march on the table wrappers. He picked up the phone and called the soft death number. "Hello, this is Low Park." Her accent was as pure New Jersey as Young's, though with a hint of Eastern melody. "Hello, this is Doug Lekesh. A man, I believe it was your brother, gave me a business card with your name on it. Soft Death Incorporated?" "Oh, yes. Young told me. I don't like to discuss this on the telephone. Could you come see me tomorrow morning, Mr. Lekesh?" 10 o'clock? That will be fine." Feeling strangely relieved, Lekesh stretched out on the couch and fell asleep. He dreamed of colors, clouds of color around a long line of precise musical tones, binary tones chanted by Low Park's musical voice. When he awoke, it was late afternoon, and Abby was sitting across the room drinking tea with a balding young man in glasses. "This is Mr. Garden, Doug. He's the medium I was telling you about." Garden smiled shyly and shook Lekesh's hand. "I'm sorry to hear of your illness, Douglas." He had gentle eyes and large, moist lips. "You have very interesting vibrations." "So do you," said Lekesh curtly. The thought of Garden alone in a dark room with Abby made him sick. "You have the vibrations of an ambulance-chasing lawyer, mixed in with the aura of a 2-bit Casanova and the emanations of a snake oil salesman. Get out of my apartment." Garden gave a low bow and left. Abby was quite angry. "It's fine for you, Doug, to act like that. Soon you'll be dead, but I'll be here all alone with no one to take care of me." Tears ran down her big cheeks. "Irwin Garden only wants to help me contact your spirit." "Let me worry about my spirit, Abby. Can't you see that Garden wants to cheat me and seduce you? I don't want jackals sniffing around my deathbed. I want to pass on peace, business as usual." His liver hurt very much. Abby sobbed harder. The fact was that she was very devoted to Lekesh. All her talk of mediums and mourning clothes was just a way to avoid thinking about his death. After a few minutes, she calmed herself and kissed him on the forehead. "Of course, Doug, I'll do as you wish. I won't see Mr. Garden again." In his embittered state, Lekesh was convinced that Abby was lying. He'd never caught her yet, but he was sure she had boyfriends. How could she not? He'd been part artist when he'd wooed her, but since then, he'd joined the stock exchange. How could Abby still love him? Well, now it didn't matter. The long game was almost over, and if there was anything to these soft death people, Lakesh was on the brink of a whole new existence. The next morning, he was back at the Beltroy building. Lo Park's office was in the basement. It was one of a number of small cubicles partitioned off along one wall of a room-sized computer installation. To all appearances, Lo worked as a programmer here. There was nothing about soft death on her flimsy office door. Lakesh wondered if he should bother going in, but the thought of outflanking Abby's occultist manipulations goaded him on. The Korean woman at the desk was young and slender, with hair so dark as to appear almost blue against her yellow skin. She looked up with a quick smile. "Mr. Lakesh, Young told me about you." "He told you I'm rich, dying, and desperate, I suppose. What kind of immortality are you selling, Lo? And what's the price?"
"The price is high. The immortality is software."
"What do you mean?"
"Consider, Mr. Lakesh. The human body changes almost all its atoms every 7 years or so. But you feel you are the same person as you were 7 or 14 or 56 years ago. What is constant in your body is the arrangement of cells, especially the cells of the brain. The real essence of Douglas Lakesh is not the 75 kilograms of deceased flesh that sits here. The essence of Douglas Lakesh is to be found in the pattern that your brain codes up. Do you follow?" Lakesh nodded approvingly.
"I was afraid you'd be another spiritualist. You're saying that my so-called soul is really just a pattern of digital information."
"Exactly. Abstractly speaking, the information pattern exists even in the absence of a body. Yet, for the pattern to be in any sense alive, it needs some sort of substrate." She smiled and gestured beyond her office door. "The soft death substrate is that computer out there, if you wish. I can extract the entire software information pattern from your body and code it into the machine."
"How do I know you can really do it? And what would it feel like to live inside a computer's memory?"
"Before we continue, Mr. Lakesh, I need a commitment from you. For various reasons, the full work of soft death is not legally sanctioned. I cannot put my earlier clients at risk without some proof of your sincerity."
"You're saying you want a check?"
"I want a document granting us title to approximately half of your properties and investments." She slid a legal paper across the desk. "I've taken the liberty of drawing it up." Lakesh scanned down the contract with a practiced eye. Soft Death Inc. had worked fast. Half his assets were lifted here, nearly $1 billion worth. In return for the billion, Soft Death was promising Lakesh hospice care and advanced embalming services.
We can't make the contract more specific, Mr. Lakesh, again, because of the legal sanctions on certain aspects of our operation."
Lakesh shrugged. Perhaps this was a con, but what was the difference anymore? If Soft Death didn't get this billion, Abby would give it to the Mr. Gardens of the world. He could feel the cancer deep in his guts. He could feel the growing of the pain.
"I'll sign."
Lo pushed a buzzer, and a man came in to witness and notarize the document. Another blue-haired Korean. They reminded Lakesh of Smurfs.
"Your brother, too?" asked Lakesh, smiling a little. Signing away this money felt good. What was that old Bible story about the rich man trying to squeeze through a needle's eye?
"No," said Lo, "a cousin." She locked the contract in her desk. "And now you'll want to see a proof that our process works. Do you remember William Cayley?"
"Bill Cayley, yes, I knew him rather well. We did business together. He died last fall, I believe. He was one of the most materialistic men I ever knew. Are you telling me?"
"Here," said Lo, punching a code into her telephone and handing Lakesh the receiver. "You can talk to him." At first, Lekesh heard only pips and bleats, but then there was a ringing and a voice. "Hello, Kaylee here. Bill, this is Doug Lekesh. Do you know what day it is?" "It's March 31st, Doug. Are you dead too?" "Damn near. Are you really inside that computer?" "Sure am. It's not bad. There's a lot of information coming in. I'm managing most of the investments I signed over to Soft Death, which keeps me busy. There's a pretty good gang of people in here." "Any landscape?" "It's not like that, Dougie, but you'd be surprised how much fun pushing around the bits can be. How soon are you coming in? I'm a little lonely for a new voice, to tell you the truth." He sounded almost wistful. "But hell, it beats being dead. When are you coming in?" "We haven't worked that out yet." Was this real? Lekesh paused, trying to remember something that would convince him he was really talking to the software of William Cayley. "That Shatner deal? Do you remember the Shatner takeover, Bill?" "Do I? Don't tell me the SEC finally found out." No, I'm just checking. Remember the night after Shatner shot himself and you and I made $12 million? Do you remember what we had for dinner?" "We went to McDonald's. The check was $12. We laughed our asses off. I could eat a million of these." "Oh, it's me in here, Doug. Don't worry." Lekesh smiled. "I'm not worried now, Bill. See you soon." He hung up and looked at Lo. "When do we start?" "Let me outline the procedure. To extract your software, we need to get 5 kinds of maps of your brain: symbolic, metabolic, electrical, physical, and chemical. Taken together, these data sets are sufficient to produce an isomorphic model of your mental processes. You should begin working on the symbolic map today." "What do you mean? I thought you would do the work." "Only you know your own symbol system, Mr. Lekesh." Lo took a device the size of a cigarette pack out of her desk. It had 2 little grills for microphone and speaker. "We call this a life box. Basically, I want you to tell it your life story. Tell everything. It takes most people a couple of weeks." "But I'm no writer." "Don't worry. The life box has prompts built into its program. It asks questions." She flicked a switch and the life box hummed. "Go on, Mr. Lekesh. Say something to it."
I'm not used to talking to machines."
"What are some of the first machines you remember, Doug?" asked the life box. Its voice was calm, pleasant, interested. Lo nodded encouragingly, and Lekesh answered the question. "The TV and my mother's vacuum cleaner. I used to love to watch the cartoon Saturday morning. Bugs Bunny was the best, and Mom would always pick that time to vacuum. It made red and green static on the TV screen." Lekesh stopped and looked at the box. "Can you understand me?" "Perfectly, Doug. I want to build up a sort of network among the concepts that matter to you. So I'm going to keep asking questions about some of the things you mention. I'll get back to the vacuum cleaner in a minute. But first, tell me this. What did you like best about Bugs Bunny?" For the next couple of weeks, Lekesh took his life box everywhere. He talked to it at home and in the club, and when Abby and his friends reproved him for ignoring them, he began talking to it in a booth at Jung's Bar. The life box was the best listener Lekesh had ever had. It remembered everything he told it, and it winnowed the key concepts out of all his stories. Lekesh would respond to its prompts or simply go off on tangents of his own. Except for the dizziness and the constant pain, he hadn't had so much fun in years. Finally, in mid-April, the life box said, "Now that's a story I've heard before, Doug. And so was the last one. And unless I'm mistaken, you're about to tell me about the first time you slept with Abby." "You're right," said Lekesh, feeling a little twinge of guilt. Telling his life had made him remember how big a part of him Abby really was. And now, for 2 weeks, he'd been too busy with the life box to even look at her. Abby, summer, Maine, 4th of July, firecrackers, cans, pineapple, Aunt Rose, roses, Abby, skin, honey, hexagons. I think we've got enough to go on now, Doug. Why don't you bring me on over to Lowe's? I've signaled her to expect us. Lekesh nodded to Jung and walked over to the Bertroy building. It was a beautiful spring day at last, with the endless blue sky leaping up from the space between the big city buildings, six shades of blue. If you looked carefully, he hadn't been able to tell the life box about colors. Lo was all smiles. You've done a good job with the life box, Mr. Lekesh. That's one of the most important steps. Now, what the life box program has done is to arrange some 10,000 of your key concepts into a kind of tree diagram. The next step is to correlate this concept network with your brain's metabolic activity. Please, come this way. Lekesh followed Lo across the computer room to the elevators. They rode up to a neurologist's office on the top floor. There was a nice view out the top halves of the windows. The bottom halves were frosted glass. The neurologist and his nurses were, of course, Korean. Working quickly, they injected Lekesh with something and laid him out on a table with his head inside a large domed sensor device. This is a PET scanner, Mr. Lekesh, explained the doctor. We want to learn just which parts of your brain react to the key concepts of your life story. The injection made Lekesh feel both stunned and lively. He couldn't move, but his mind was going a mile a minute. The PET scan sensor seemed like a cavern, a door into the underworld. The doctor set the life box down on Lekesh's chest, and the box began its rapid-fire rundown. Machine, TV, vacuum cleaner, Bugs Bunny, rudeness, teeth, dogs. After each word or phrase, the PET scanner would click. The process went on for the whole afternoon. Pineapple, cans, firecrackers, 4th of July, Maine, summer, Abby. Finally, it was over. The doctor injected an antidote. Lekesh's body speeded back up and his mind slowed back down. Lo took him downstairs to her cubicle. The long afternoon's ordeal had left him so weak that he walked with a stooped shuffle. Well, that's it, Mr. Lekesh, until the end. We'll get the electrical, physical, and chemical maps at the end. The end? After I die? He looked a little uncomfortable. This is where the hospice comes in. We can't take the risk of having your brain degenerate before we can analyze it. For the electrical probes to give reliable readings, the brain still has to be somewhat functional. Unless the tissues are absolutely fresh, the physical microtoming process works very poorly, and memory RNA is an extremely labile substance. The coordination of your brain removal with our team's readiness is a delicate thing. Now hold on a minute. What are you saying? Lo's yellow face and blue hair made Lekesh think of a nightmare by Van Gogh. I told you that some aspects of our operation are legally questionable, Mr. Lekesh. Each syllable came out just so. You're telling me that I'm supposed to make an appointment for your doctors to shock me to death and cut up my brain and grind up the pieces for a chemical analysis? We need a day's notice, is all. When you get to the point where you think the end is near, Mr. Lekesh, you simply get in touch with Soft Death, and our ambulance will take you to our hospice. What if I wait too long? Lo shrugged. It's a matter of statistics, like everything else. Here. She took what looked like a wristwatch out of her desk. Wear this. To signal us to come get you, simply push this button here. The watch also has sensors that signal us automatically in case you collapse. Let me stress that the chances of our achieving a fully isomorphic copy of your software are much greater if you come in early. Quite frankly,
I'd advise coming in today. I think the crisis is much closer than you realize. You're just in a hurry to claim your half of my assets, challenged Lekish, suddenly wild with fear. His guts were on fire and his head was spinning. We already have half of your assets, corrected Lo. The document you signed was a contract, not a will. And by the way, for another quarter of your assets, we would be able to provide software transmission as well as the planned preservation. I'm getting out of here, shouted Lekish in a strained, cracking voice. Soft death is a bunch of vampires and ghouls. In the cab home, he began coughing blood. He wondered if the soft death neurologist had poisoned him. This had all been a horrible mistake. He'd never been able to take Bill Cayley for more than an hour at a time, and now he was supposed to spend eternity in a machine with Cayley and a bunch of other rich fools. He found Abby alone in the apartment, talking on the phone with Mr. Garden. Lekish was so desperate to see his wife that he didn't bother to be annoyed. Oh, Abby, I've been selfish. I'm sorry. I've been ignoring you these past few weeks. Where's your little recorder, Doug? Did you finish dictating your life story? Her pale, anxious face was luminous in the apartment's gathering dusk. It's all done. Kiss me, Abby. They hugged and kissed for a long time. Lekish wondered how he could have thought that his words were more important than Abby's real self, her real body, with its real curves and its sweet, real fragrance, and even more real than that, her aura, the married couple telepathy they had together, the precious, unspoken understanding of two people in love. Doug? What, darling? What have you been up to, really? What were you always talking into that little box for? I know it wasn't a recorder, like you said. I heard it talking back to you. And there's something else. I went to the bank today and half of our money is gone. The teller said some group called Soft Death had a paper giving them the right to take half of our money out. What is Soft Death, Doug? Abby's voice quavered and broke. Is it another woman you've been talking to? I wouldn't blame you, Doug, with so little time left. But why don't you let me help you, too? Lekish's heart swelled as if to burst. After all the bad things he'd thought about Abby in the past, she really did care. She cared more than anyone. Yet still, he couldn't tell her. It was Soft Death or nothing, wasn't it? There was no immortality outside of their machine. Soft Death is a kind of hospice, a home for the terminally ill. I signed a contract so I could go there when the cancer gets really bad. I might have to go pretty soon. I coughed blood in the cab, Abby, and I'm hurting bad. But half our money, Doug? They pressured me, Abby, and it's not just a hospice. I can't tell you more. You might mess it up. We've both always had our secrets, haven't we? The pain in his stomach was beating like a bass drum. Oh, Doug, you've gotten so suspicious of me. There haven't been any secrets, darling. It's only because you were older than I that you worried so much. You're all I... Something collapsed in Lekish's guts. He pitched forward onto his knees and vomited blood. The sensor in Lowe's wristwatch sent out a signal to the Soft Death ambulance that had trailed Lekish's taxi home. The funeral was 2 days later. The only mourner, aside from Abby, was Irwin Garden, with his baggy pants and turbaned mind. Over Abby's protests, he accompanied her back to her apartment. I promised Doug not to see you, said Abby, pacing distractedly up and down the richly furnished living room. She stared out the window and turned to look at Garden's calm face. His arched eyebrows showed over his glasses. Abby made up her mind. Doug will forgive me. He and I still had so much to tell each other. He needs me, Irwin. I can feel it. Can you help me reach him? I can try. Garden opened up his battered briefcase and
drew out a large square of silk with a Tibetan mandala on it. He set it down on the dining table, and he and Abby sat down on either side of Lekesh's old seat. Garden lit a stick of incense and began reading from a book he said was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Time passed. Abby let Garden's droning voice wash over her as she thought and thought of Doug. It was nearly dark now, and the plume of incense smoke was dense above the silken mandala. The table creaked and shifted. The thick smoke began to give off a faint blue glow. Garden fell silent. "Doug," said Abby, staring into the luminous smoke. "Doug, are you there?" The smoke had no words. It only moaned, turning in on itself. "Is something wrong, Doug? Tell me. Show me." A pattern formed in the air, indistinct as a cheap hologram, but multicolored with rainbow fringes at each color volume's edge. The face of Douglas Lekesh, his tormented face. Now the face shrank to the size of a fist, and pale color lines enveloped it. "A ghost trap," said Garden softly. "It's telling you that something has his spirit trapped here on Earth." Bright blips raced along the color lines, surrounding Lekesh's face. Bright digital blips. His moaning chattered into the sound of typewriters. "Is it soft death, Doug?" The pulsing lines fell away, and his spirit face nodded. Somewhere in the apartment, a window blew open with a crash. There was a sudden strong wind, and something white fluttered in from the bedroom, a small white rectangle. The incense smoke dispersed, and the mandala cloth wafted onto the floor. Doug's face was gone, but there, lying on the table between Abby and Irwin, was a dog-eared business card, the soft death business card that Young had given Lekesh 3 weeks ago. Abby was at the Bertroy building when it opened next morning. After lengthy inquiries, she found herself in Low Park's basement cubicle. "What have you done to my husband?" demanded Abby. The young Korean woman was cool and matter-of-fact. "Soft Death Incorporated has preserved his software according to his request." "What do you mean?" "We coded up Douglas Lekesh's brain functions as a pattern of zeros and ones in the computer out there. Would you like to talk with him?" "I communicated with him last night." The Korean woman twitched her eyebrows unbelievingly. "I will telephone him for you." She punched some buttons and handed Abby the receiver. There was a chiming and a buzzing, and then a voice, Doug's voice. "Hello?" He sounded bored and unhappy. "Doug, is it really you?" I don't know, Abby. You're with Low Park?" "Yes. She says you're in her computer, but last night, Irwin Garden called your spirit out of thin air." A sob of anguish. "I was a fool, Abby. I should have believed you. Get me out of here. It's like an endless business meeting. Oh, it's like hell." "Your spirit wants you out too, but it couldn't talk." "All they have in here is my digital code," said Lekesh's voice, "but not the rest of me. I can hardly remember it in here, Abby. The colors and smells, the feelings you gave me. It's wrong for my two parts to be split this way. I was a fool to think I was nothing but numbers. I need to get out of here and move on to the other side." "I'll save you, darling." It didn't take Low Park long to draw up a contract for half of what Abby had left. In return, Soft Death promised information transmission. That afternoon, a long, powerful radio signal was beamed straight up from a dish on the top of the Bertroy building. The signal coded a certain digital information pattern, a bit string derived from the software of the late Douglas Lekesh. Radio signals are invisible, but if you'd been watching the sky as the Lekesh beam went up, you might have seen an iridule, a bright swirl of rainbow light. We continue with a story from the October 1985 issue of the magazine A Fantasy and science fiction. This is Hard to Credit by John Brunner and O. Henry. Forward. For a considerable while, I've been planning a series of imaginary collaborations with some of the authors who have influenced my work. Here's the first to emerge. Devotees of O. Henry will recognize Jeff Peters and Andy Tucker, and maybe one or two other constituents of the eventual mix. Let's just suppose, then, that the narrator of the stories collected under the title The Gentle Grafter were to meet his interlocutor a century later and through a computer keyboard. "Talk to any dead people lately?" inquired the guy who signs on to Cosmonet with the handle Jeff Peters Jr. I've never met him face to face, of course, and all I know about him is that he's a former corporation lawyer and a millionaire in a small way of business. I have a vague impression that he operates out of a tax haven in the Caribbean, but like everybody else on the net, he could be anywhere. He and I don't have all that much in common, but I'm always glad when he's free for a chat. When you're bored and insomniac, Cosmonet surely beats playing channel roulette among rerun quiz games, and I take it he feels the same way. At any rate, judging by the shape of his code, he must have been on the net since way back when. Trying to match what I deduced was a bantering tone, I answered, "Haven't met a happy medium in a long while. So, what have you been doing?" "The usual. My credit's been running dry again because I missed a deadline." I didn't have to explain what kind, because anyone I meet through the net has already been told I'm a writer. "Tonight's chat isn't only off the cuff, but on the cuff. I don't suppose you found someone who could take it with him." Instantly, I regretted that. The guy might think I was trying to tap him for a loan, and indeed, his response suggested so. "Afraid not, but if you want to pick up on a story about someone whose credit ran out completely, you might try Andy Tucker. Code follows. Sorry I can't stick around, but I just got an urgent call." Blank screen, maybe permanently. I cursed my mistake, but I still wasn't sleepy, and I found myself wondering about this mysterious Mr. Tucker. Even if he was a knot-headed psychic, I might pass an entertaining hour with him. So I called back the code Jeff Peters had given me and punched it into the board, and I didn't get in the least what I had bargained for. The screen said suddenly, "Andy Tucker is talk-tempted." I countered, "Match?" and appended the group defining the subjects I can chat about. It's a long list and takes more than a second to pass. Almost at once, and to my vast surprise, the screen told me, "Congruence 0.7, go ahead." Well, even if that indicated only that Andy Tucker had entered several different lists, one of which largely overlapped mine, it had been ages since I had found a congruence better than 0.5 with a total stranger. I cheered up and gave a prompt answer. "Affirmative. Stand drink? You pick." Naturally, the system automatically limited the range of drinks a stranger might bill me for. Since my credit rating had been slashed, I suddenly realized I could be offering this total stranger a cup of synthetic coffee, and as soon as he tasted it, he might well quit. I was wrong, because the screen was saying, "Thanks, but no thanks. I can't drink." By now, I must be presumed dead. Quote marks hereinafter omitted. What? And I punched in exactly that, thinking of pranks and practical jokes. The screen answered, "You are communicating with a posthumous program. You are number one to do so. Access threshold was initially set at 0.9 congruence, reduced after 5 years to 0.8, after 7 years to 0.7. So I was supposed to be talking to a ghost? Well, Cosmonet must be full of all sorts of nonsense that rich or dedicated idiots had found time and money for. After over a decade, would one not expect so much? Entering into the spirit of what I took to be a game, I tapped, "How's life after death?"
Back came, great. How's life before death, if any? A fairly stock gimmick, I decided, based on the kind of program I used to have to write in pharmacy school to get patients to confess all the harm they were doing to their minds and bodies. I was growing sleepy at last. Why bother to carry on? Dreams for me have always been at least as exciting as real life. Still, Andy Tucker had a novel approach. I played along. Terrible. I ran out of credit, so you might not have got that drink anyway. You ran out of credit? I sighed. That trick of modifying and feeding back what the other party punched in went back to the early, early days of human-computer interaction. I poised my hand to hit the key that would remove me from the net, but the screen beat me to it. So did I. Care to hear about it? What the hell? I punched run. Dead or not, Andy Tucker had left a good live program. What it told me went like this. I used to work for a firm in New Silicon Valley back when promising ideas were spinning off faster than mud from the tires of a Camaro on a wet road. Some of them messed up rich guys' suits, but an awful lot went to join the dog dirt. A notion that I came up with stuck tight enough to the boss's pants for me to afford a vacation on an island where booze was cheap, the main industry was lying in the sunshine to acquire an all-over tan, and every second kid on the main drag of the one and only town was wearing a promotional t-shirt and primed with sales talk for banks all set up to go rupt next week, but any applicant with less than $100,000 needn't waste their time. I won't tell you what the rest were up to, but some of them can't have been more than 8 or 9. Me, I was eating off plastic, so I didn't much care. I carried all the major credit cards, and the firm I'd just left had underwritten my stay in a high-class hotel and an open account with a car rental company, so pretty soon I found I was beginning to forget what ordinary money looked like. Mind you, what few bills I saw down there, mainly ones I gave as tips, did leave the impression that somebody must have used them for toilet paper at least once. Then, one morning I pushed my Ultra card into the phone beside the bed. I never asked for a wake-up call when I was on vacation, and got set to order breakfast. And I waited, and I waited, and suddenly it dawned on me I was listening to a tone that meant locally, phone out of service. So, I rolled out of bed and went to take a shower. I'd had a fairly heavy night before and needed a thorough dousing to wake me up. Same again. I fed all my cards in turn into all the right slots and no hot water. No water of any kind. Come to that, nor any power. I couldn't even brush my teeth, let alone shave. I wasn't even able to flush the can. Time to go and complain to the management. I got dressed in yesterday's clothes and headed for the reception desk, primed to raise hell. My room was on the 6th floor, and when I stuck my cards in the slot beside the elevator, they got spat right back at me. So I had to trudge down not 6, but 8 flights of stairs because the hotel had 2 floors worth of service areas just above ground level. And whom should I find waiting for me at the reception desk? Oh, not the manager. I guess he was still asleep, but a guy from the car rental company I'd been using, and a girl from the restaurant I'd patronized last night, and someone else from the firm that owed the beach concession nearest the hotel, and about 20 or 30 people just arrived on a package tour, all of whom were within earshot when I had to try and explain why everything I'd charged to my credit cards since arriving on the island had just been rejected by the computers back home. It looked as though I'd gone bust to the tune of a good 10,000. Worst of all, the owners of the hotel were naturally in cahoots with the island police, who had turned out in force, and I was hauled kicking and screaming through the lobby on the grounds that I was utterly uncreditworthy and probably a confidence trickster. But the whole deal was ridiculous. I could prove I had a balance of at least 6 figures. I swore at the top of my voice that I was going to get even with the sons of bitches who had accused me of doing too broke to meet my bills. A few minutes later, I was dragged out of the hotel. My lawyer phoned to discuss the details of a deal we had going, and when he found my calls were being referred to the local jail, he sprang into action. He jumped on the next plane and brought with him all the data he could lay hands on concerning the firm that handled credit card transactions on the island. It was called IloCred, one of those typically parasitical operations, largely funded by laundered crime syndicate money, of course, that got in early when the islands were opened up to cheap tourism and were eager to sell land and other concessions to rich outsiders. But they had one problem. They had themselves laid it down as part of the deal that any financial transactions should be subject to the laws of, well, never mind where. Just say I was overjoyed to find out that my confidence in the justice of my homeland was not misplaced. Then, though, came what looked like a real blow to my career prospects. I had a considerable reputation as an expert in DDR, difficult data retrieval, and I'd never have quit my previous job had I not had a strong bid from another firm at twice my former salary. I was expecting to take them up on it as soon as I got home. And my lawyer got a call, relayed from his office, to say my prospective new employers had heard this disturbing rumor about my financial stability. I blew my top with a vengeance, but the fact that I was actually well in credit at my own bank was down and documented, and an hour or two after my lawyer showed up, the locals were starting to look distinctly unhappy. You see, my legal chum was a member of a partnership that represented not only the hotel chain I'd picked for my vacation, but also two of the banks involved in the IloCred consortium, on which, naturally, the blame must rest for this foul and libelous accusation against well-heeled and entirely respectable tourists. And their expressions of gloom became positively thunderous when my mouthpiece arranged for me to be provided with a TV set and copies of the local newspaper. They still had one on the island in those days. Real wool pulp paper and horrible black ink that came off on your fingers. And I discovered that one of the junior entrepreneurs on the main drag had fed the story of my arrest to a wire service, and it was a dull day for other kind of news, so it was making international headlines. Maybe I exaggerate. It did get noised around my hometown, though, where a sub who'd had a grudge against me since we were in third grade made sure to put it on the cable system serving my parents and their friends, and more to the point, it was also circulated in the area where I was expecting to find my next job. Hence that call my legal eagle had received, inquiring about my status. By sundown, I was practically foaming at the mouth, but my bank had faxed in a notarized certificate of my credit, so my lawyer insisted on my release. The duty judge having quit for the day, though, the best he could do was get me out on bail. So we went together to the newspaper station and the TV station and informed them I was quitting the island right now and that as soon as I got home, I was determined to tell the world what I thought of their crummy operation and especially IloCred. But, I said, I looked forward to coming back to stand my trial and promised I'd make sure there were reporters in attendance. And when I'd been found not guilty of defrauding the hotel and the car rental company and the rest of my accusers, I'd carry on and sue IloCred for every cent they had. We were just leaving the TV station after being interviewed on the evening news, and we'd come as a godsend to the guy in charge, who hadn't had this hot a story in months, when a suave type who clearly wasn't local emerged from a long black limousine and making sufficient gestures towards a bulge under his jacket, invited us to join him in the car. We deigned to do so. 15 minutes later, we were in the presence of someone who spoke with the voice of authority. He had, he said, been in touch with a considerable number of his associates, and they were unanimous in regretting what had happened. It must all have been due to an error in the IloCred computer system, and they had experts working on it right now, and it seemed likely that my name and or my credit card numbers had been confused with those employed by a known defaulter who had been reported in the area, etc., etc., etc. Would we accept his apologies and perhaps some small compensation for the inconvenience? By now, I'd compressed from mere fury to a kind of cold anger. I said it would take large, not small, compensation to make up for the loss of such a high salary as I'd been in line for. And what about my vacation? I still had a week to go, and it had been completely ruined, and I certainly wasn't going to accept anything like free room and board in the same hotel where my reputation had been slandered to all and sundry, and you get the picture. Besides, my lawyer pal assured him, we could expect a very generous award from any court that heard our case. Declaring someone uncreditworthy through the medium of a computer has been held in more than one instance to constitute a gross libel, even though it be by error, if the victim's public reputation was thereby significantly tarnished. What have I just been telling you? I interrupted. The personage we had come to see pondered a while, then invited us to stay put while he adjourned to another room and debated with his associates on a conference phone linking. A silent flunky brought us drinks. We said nothing but brooded. Shortly, our host returned and named a figure, and we accepted. It was clear from his tone and manner what would happen if we didn't. He put us back in his limousine and sent us to the airport, and when we got home, we found he'd kept his promise. So I credited Jeff his share of the proceeds, and, "Hold on," I burst out, and on remembering he couldn't hear me, tapped the same into the board, adding, "Was your lawyer the guy I know as Jeff Peters, Jr.?" The screen said, "Chuckle. How else do you think I raised the money to launch Cosmonet? You mean you're admitting you rigged the whole deal? I told you, I am dead, or at any rate, the statute of limitations must apply, which amounts to the same thing. Otherwise, nobody could access this program. Nice talking to you, Mr. Henry." "Wait!" "Yes?" "If you were the guy who founded Cosmonet, surely..." I got that far when the screen was preempted. "Oh, I didn't want my coup to remain a secret forever. Say I was vain. Say I still am, if you like. I must have been a conceited bastard to think of leaving this program behind, mustn't I? Even if I'm not dead after all. Good night." This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.